So, another day, another talk, and still plenty of time left. Usually it's the case that people try so hard, and when they try hard, they find it doesn't work. But when they give up, then it works. Already mentioned about the story of the donkey and the carrot. But there's another story I haven't mentioned yet. It was one of the first stories which I learned from Ajahn Chah. In the first few months, I went to stay with him in the northeast of Thailand. And it was a crazy story. I thought that Ajahn Chah was just really losing it. And I was right, he'd lost a lot. But it was this simile of the mango trees. And there's lots of similes of mango trees. They're one of the first similes. This is not Ajahn Chah's simile, but one which I always recall, that there were two mango trees and a king was coming back with his soldiers, having supervised some exercises. And as he came past these two mango trees, one mango tree had hardly anything at all. No fruits, but lots of branches and lots of leaves. The second mango tree was full of fruit, and you could smell them, that they were all ripe and ready to pick. And the king thought, when I get back to the palace and get changed, I'll come back and taste some of these mangoes. And so he went back to the palace, and when he came back to those two mangoes to enjoy some mangoes, he found that all the soldiers, they hadn't waited to get changed. They'd been up there taking all the mangoes, and that mango tree, which once had lots and lots of mangoes, just was all broken and leaves strewn all over the place and branches torn off. It looked like it had been through just some so great catastrophe. It looked broken and wounded. But the mango tree, which had no fruit on it at all, stood there untouched. Same with lots of leaves and lots of branches. And then he got the simile that people who have lots of wealth, like a tree which has lots of mangoes, there'll be someone trying to take that wealth away from you. If not the government, if not the tax office, if not your relations, and then your favorite monks and nuns. No, but it was not that, so I just made that up. But just when you see those mango trees, you can actually understand that sometimes the more you have, the more you have to protect. Whether it's attainments, whether it's reputation, even like knowledge as well. You start knowing very little in this life, and you end forgetting everything you've learnt. Dementia, losing stuff. But it's going to face many of us. But when it does, isn't it nice to be free? I saw my mum with dementia, and she was, one of the wonderful things about dementia was that when I went into the unit in St. Albans, in just north of London, that my brother was with me, and he commented, "Look, your mother, she's not wearing her dress. I never bought that for her, because my brother looked after all her needs." And then he stopped himself and just laughed and said, "Oh yeah, that's normal." Because when you had dementia, you didn't have any sense of ownership. There's no sense of self. So she would go in a room, find a nice dress, and liked it and put it on. And people went into her room and put her dresses on. And I thought that was something really cute. That when we have clothes and ownership and stuff, so if anybody wants to put my dress on, I'll ordain you. Now that's one. So sometimes you look at these things and ownership. What's yours? What's ours? And stuff. That's part of when we have a wise mind. So it's our trees. It's our retreat center. It's our monastery. It doesn't belong to a person. It's not mine. And it's wonderful if we could. Now, some of those things, when you lose your sense of ownership, is it your child which you're worried about? It's not yours. They come into your body, into your family. Where they come from, you don't know. And when they just go out on a Friday, Saturday night, you can't follow them. It's too noisy. But we have to let things go. We care for them, but we don't own them. And even your body is the same. You care for your body, but you don't own it. Which means you can let it go. But anyway, so the other simile of the mango tree, which was more what I was wanted to talk about this morning, was some of the really incredibly deep insights. And that mango orchard, which Ajahn Chah talked about, was that his monastery, Wat Bon Pong, he said, was a mango orchard planted by the Buddha, which it obviously wasn't. So it was one of these metaphors. And he said, those mango trees planted by the Buddha, they've all got so many thousands, innumerable mangoes on them, ready to eat. But he said, if you climb that mango tree, you'll never get the mango. You'll never reach it. If you shake that tree, it will not fall. No ladder will reach it. You throw sticks at the mangoes to try to hit them to get them to fall. That won't work either. They never had cherry pickers in those days, but, you know, just they wouldn't work either. There's only one way to get those mangoes which had been planted by the Buddha, and that is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Perfectly still. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. What do you think about that? Do you think what I thought? That is, with all respects to Ajahn Chah, go my young. That doesn't work. I've never seen that happen. Have you seen that happen? Mango fall when you're sitting underneath it? And of course, if it did fall, where would it fall? On your head or something like that. That's what happened to Newton. He fell on his head, but that was an apple. But the chances of it actually falling in your hand when it's open. So it made no sense to me, like it probably doesn't make sense to you. But those stories, those metaphors, they stayed a long time in the mind. That somehow or other, there's some teachings are seeds which are planted, and they germinate and they come up to your consciousness at the right time and the right place when they're needed. And that is weird, but that's how it happens. So later on when you're meditating, later on when you had a bit more experience, not just of theory, but of actually practice, then you realize what an amazing, accurate simile that was. What you had to do was to be still, perfectly still. But more than that, to open up your hand, like open up the door of your heart. Kindness, compassion, openness. And then the mango just falls into it. Strange. But that's what happens. The more you try and shake that tree, the more you strive in your meditation, the more you'll be wasting your time. When you try and climb the tree, you never reach it. Or even worse, when you figure out other ways of getting that mango, you have all these, well, maybe I can get it this way. Maybe I can get a trampoline and just bounce up there. Maybe I can get a few other friends and we can actually climb on each other's shoulders. Maybe I can make... But whatever you think, there's only that one way, to be still and open your heart. And then those fruits of the Dhamma just fall in. And of course, people struggle and strive, they try, and they try this and they try that. They get so far, but there comes a time you just have to sit down and let go, be still. And that's even why, you know, that I sometimes ask, I remember just when I was staying, when I was teaching in Bunbury Jail and staying overnight in the Catholic parish house in Bunbury, because I asked them, where did that come from in the Christian Bible? It's in Psalms. That be still and know that thou art God. It was almost like there was some influence there of meditation, real meditation. Be still. Don't do something. And that's why I also like the great phrase of Thich Nhat Hanh, who once said, just don't do something. Just sit there. It's usually the other way around. Whenever there's a problem, a difficulty, they say, just don't just sit there, do something. I said, no. Turned it around the other way, like I was saying last night, so in insight, the other day. Turn things upside down. Don't just do something, sit there. Because in stillness, this is where great things happen. And little by little, you try and trick people into being still, really peaceful. And as I say, as things disappear, not only do you get peaceful and happy, then you can start to appreciate the sounds of the birds. Thank you for stopping when I wanted you to do something, birds. You see, they're very good. Instead of just doing something, they just sat there. They were quiet and still. So when we are learn about how to be still, there is something which happens. One thing which happens is when we are still, our sense of self vanishes. To exist, we have to do things. So that was that graffiti. I saw that with my own eyes when I was in Cambridge. It was on the walls of the philosophy department over in Cambridge. And that was the saying of Descartes, René Descartes, which was to do is to be. And then Sartre, the French philosopher, existentialist, said, no, it's not to do is to be is to do. And then that was all summed up by the American philosopher, very famous, but never got a degree in university, which was Frank Sinatra, yes, doobie doobie doo. That was the joke of it. But there was first part of it was really important. When you stop doing things, your sense of self disappears. This is why it's hard to get people to sit still. Because it's challenging who you think you are. It's challenging your identity of the great... what do you do in your life anyway? Are you a doctor? It's just what you do. Are you an academic? A professor? It's just what you do. Are you a monk? A nun? It's just what I do, is it? Who are you anyway? And often we define ourselves by what we do. If you take away all of that, what you do in your life, then who are you? So it challenges us to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into stripping off all of these petals, or if you like, all of these coverings, to see what's really underneath that. When you don't do anything, that's why when people retire, and they don't know what to do when they retire, because sometimes that they've been identified with, you know, their roles for such a long time. Or our great athletes sometimes don't know what to do once they've, you know, left their profession, left the peak of their profession at such an early time in their life. So what do you do? Who are you? So little by little, it's not really who we are, but who we think we are, who we identify with. Who do you take yourself to be? And I didn't mention earlier a little bit about that, that sometimes that we're told who we are at a very early age. And that simile which I gave, not a simile, it was an experiment, sorry, of the two classes of children, the Class A kids and the Class B kids. And just once that was reinforced into them, it was a really quite an amazing experiment, but not much good for those people, those kids who were put in Class B, and thought Class B was the inferior class, and they lived up to that label. But sometimes what we think we are, what we're told we are, that is who we become. And it's amazing that when we start questioning all of that, are you a Class B person? Are you a Class A person? Are you intelligent? When I was a school teacher, I did my own experiments. One kid, I was teaching maths, and one kid was obviously, he was the kid who was the bottom of the class the year before, 30th, in a class of 30 in those days. And I was told by the teacher of the class the year before, this guy just is hopeless. It's a boy in a mixed school. But I wanted to challenge that. Is it a case that this kid could not do math? It's all part of the understanding of anatta. Is that who you are? A boy who is only maybe 13 or 14 who can't do math? So I just took him aside at the end of every class. When I was strolling past the desks, I was just stopped always at him and said, how are you going? Did you understand that? Gave him special attention, just encouraged him, and just really built him up. It was at the expense of the other children, that was the bad part of it. But the interesting part of it, because we encouraged him and just gave him extra time, mostly it was for the encouragement rather than the extra time, that he came top at the end of that year. And it was all it wasn't he couldn't do math, he just needed encouragement, confidence. So, for you, how's your meditation been? Maybe I should, when you're meditating, just stop by you and say, did you understand that? Did you get that? You can do it. Yes, you can. Come on, give it another try. And then you become top of the class. In other words, it works for you. So, sometimes we think, I can't meditate. You tried it, and then you just put yourself in a box where you can't get out. Or you think, I get sick. Put yourself in a box and you can't get out. You probably mentioned this one. I told, first year as a monk, I think I had already had my episode with scrub typhus. But then so many monks were getting sick in Thailand, mostly because of digestive problems. So I actually told monks, just being the arrogant young man, now I'm the arrogant old man, I suppose, but I don't know, am I? Who am I? whatever you want to be. But anyway, at this particular time, I decided everyone was getting sick, and just for, I don't know if it was for a joke or it was for just a test, I made a determination in front of everybody else. Okay, for the next year, I am not going to get sick. What a stupid thing to say you're not going to get sick. But it worked. For the next 12 months, the biggest sickness was diarrhea, or sometimes even worse, the dysentery. But all the other monks, you know, we'd get up in the morning, because the food was disgusting, it was dirty, no hygiene. It was just, I remember Ajahn Yana telling me once, I was listening to one of his talks, and he was saying just when people would give food in the morning, you know, the villagers, you know, there was cold weather, so they're just about to put their hand in the sticky rice basket to drop in your bowl, but then they were sneezing a bit, so they'd put it in the bowl. It was village life. So no wonder we got, you know, all sorts of stuff in our tummies and just diarrhea and stuff. But I always remember that for that year, in the morning, the monks were up there. It was a terrible night last night. And I was on the toilet all night, or most of the night. And they said, oh yeah, me too, there must have been something there. And somebody else said, oh yeah, me as well. And I said, oh yeah, me too. And they come to me, because I was a junior monk, and I said, I had a nice night's sleep. And they didn't have mudita. They had, But you know, sometimes I was messing around just with the power of, you know, the mind, and just to determine it. It's still sort of sometimes wonder just what goes on there, how the mind can interfere with these things. So sometimes you say, I can't meditate. What do you mean? Well, I haven't got nimittas yet. The important word is yet. They're coming. They're on the way. The check is in the mail. Because a lot of times, I don't think I mentioned the two types of waiting. There's two types of waiting. And the first is the one which we know and practice, and which stops us gaining any sense of peace or happiness. And that is waiting in the future. Waiting for something to happen. Even though, oh, it's a wonderful retreat, I've got another day, people have still already started packing their bags, waiting for the retreat to end. Oh, they're still waiting for the talk to end. Oh, they're waiting for something to happen. We have, be peaceful, when's the nimitta going to come? When we wait for something to happen, we're waiting in the future. We're not here, we're expecting. Waiting for the next thing to come. If you see that, you'll understand one of the great causes for the lack of present moment awareness and contentment, and allowing the present moment to grow into something beautiful and profound and deep, with all sorts of interesting wisdom and insights and peace and happiness. Always waiting for something to happen next. So we don't wait in the future. That will never come. What we do is wait on the present, like a waiter. And a waiter just watches the customer, and the customer is your peace of mind, your stillness, and to see what it needs. So the waiter, observe, you've finished the first course, and just comes without you asking, just to give you the next course. And knows that whether you're ready for the next course or not, because sometimes, you know, you are just busy talking to your friend. And a good waiter, every moment, is waiting in this moment and knows how to respond, how to care, not to control, not to anticipate, not to plan. Because if you have plans, you're waiting in the future, waiting to get to some destination, you'll find you really mess up your life. You know, this was a person who was, he told me this story up in the dining room of Jhana Grove many years ago. And he said that he was, he's an Aussie, but he was doing business in Mumbai. And when he finished his business, he ordered the taxi to take him to the international airport to get his next flight back to Europe. And as he ordered the taxi, many of those taxi drivers were poor people, migrants from, you know, outside of Mumbai, getting whatever job they could. And so this driver didn't know the way to the airport. And you'd expect a taxi driver, that's one destination they would always know, especially from the area in the city where the hotels were. It reminded me of when I first landed in Bangkok, very small airport in Don Mueang. It was really small in 1974. And even just going down that road, you know, there were paddy fields just around sort of Luxi and all those other little places which are now just so full of things. So anyway, I got the airport limo. You know, just not really a limo, just a van with about six or seven seats in the back. And the driver asked me, so what hotel do you want to go to? I said, I don't want to go to hotel, I want to go to monastery, to ordain. So he looked at me and said, no, hotel. Said, no, monastery. And so he just, and so he took all the other business travelers to their hotels, so I was the last person in the van. And then he said, hotel, you know, he gave a little picture of a hotel. He said, no, monastery. And he eventually took me to Watsaket, but he was really sort of confounded. So, you know, I never sort of just did anything else except just go to Bangkok to become a monk. That was what I went there for. And that's how much I really wanted to become a monk. But anyway, now, where was the story going before I got off on a tangent again? That was when... What?
The Bombay
taxi driver. That taxi driver, yes, all about taxis. So that taxi driver got lost. This guy got lost. You may not know the way for the temple, but you should know the way to the airport and the hotels. So he took me... This taxi driver in Mumbai went all over the place getting lost. And as he was getting lost more and more, the time was ticking on. And this poor businessman was getting more and more agitated. The time was getting so late that he thought he was going to miss the flight. He was getting more and more angry. And he got to the point where he thought the only way he could catch that flight is if it was delayed. Which happened. That's why they always used to say that, you know, the TG for the Thai flights, you know what TG stands for? Tomorrow, go. Anyway, so that there he was, and when he got close to the airport, he realized that he was late, he missed his flight. Because he saw through the taxi window his flight take off. And you know, if you ever do miss a flight, it's so difficult. You've got all your connections and people you have to tell that you're going to arrive late, and you have, oh, it's just so confusing. So, well, this particular person got very angry at the taxi driver. You should know how to get there, you stupid taxi driver. Of all the places we left in plenty of time, why did you do this? You should know something. I know that sometimes Westerners get very upset, and the poor taxi driver was just sitting there, just, you know, just getting very embarrassed. But at that point, he saw through the window, both of them saw the aircraft come down. It crashed. I think it was a very well-known KLM crash from the Mumbai airport. I forget what year it was. Everybody was killed. You wonderful taxi driver. Thank you so much. You're the best. Take a tip. You saved my life. But he said that experience, you know, did sort of affect him deeply. The flight in which he should have been on would have killed him. And all the time he was getting so angry, all his plans, which has never came true, all his expectations, never eventuated, waiting in the future, getting angry when your future plans don't work, getting frustrated when what you thought should happen did not happen. How often do we plan the future and what happens is not what we plan at all? And if we know how to wait in the moment instead of waiting in the future, a great source of irritation and anger are taken away from us. We learn how to be, rather than always having to get somewhere and getting frustrated when we don't achieve our goals and expectations. So you can understand sometimes you have to do that in life, but do it understanding that sometimes it won't work. Sometimes the flight will be delayed. Sometimes that things do go wrong. Sometimes the internet doesn't work. Sometimes, which has happened the last 36 hours here, sometimes, but we welcome that that is our life and we can adapt. One of the times that I missed my flight, that was going to Indonesia on Garuda, and the flight wasn't delayed, it was cancelled. I got to the airport and people were waiting at the other end. I was going to give a talk, about, I don't know, 1,000 people or something. I was going to give a talk and went up to the counter and said, cancelled. So what did I do? Great, marvellous, now I can have a rest tonight. I don't have to give a talk because no one knows that I've got nothing to do. So I can go back to Nolamara Centre and just have a nice relaxing meditate and walk and talk. I walk and sort of meditate and have a nice sleep. But then when I got back to Nolamara, still had to sort of let people know that flight had been cancelled. And they were a bit upset, obviously. And I said, well, you know all my old stories and jokes, and you can have a new one now because, you know, I know the reason why the flight was cancelled. You know, it was the middle of the... Remember the bird flu crisis? Bird flu in sort of Southeast Asia. And I said, well, you know, Garuda's a bird. It's got the flu. And so the monk said that. And when you made a joke about it, apparently the audience laughed and said, okay, never mind. It happens. So anyway, that sometimes when do things actually go wrong? Do things go wrong in life? No, it just goes, you know, according to the cause and effect. You can't say it goes wrong. It's just that you misunderstood the cause and effects and you couldn't actually predict them. So a wise person is always open and willing for things to go wrong and make use of them afterwards. When things do go wrong, don't get upset. Take advantage of them. So if I get stuck, I got stuck in a traffic jam once when I was, not once, many times, when I was going to give a talk in London. And so, you know, usually I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And so when I was getting stuck in a traffic jam and I was really late, then when I got to the venue, I gave a talk on Buddhism
and traffic jams. And it's one of my best talks because, you know, traffic jams, what do? They just show you how little you are in control of your life. You have all these plans of what you're going to do when you get there. And it means you get tense and upset. For me, I was just looking out the window, relaxing, meditating. And so that's what we do. We get traffic jams. You can't do anything. So there's great advantages in traffic jams. At least you don't have to worry about getting caught by speed cameras. And you can relax more. You can be more peaceful. You find out that life never goes according to your agenda. And so you waste the time getting upset. I remember at that Perth airport seeing gentlemen banging their fists on the counter. You can't do this to me. Get another plane now. I've got to get to Jakarta now. And I felt really sorry for the poor person who's fielding all these complaints. It wasn't her fault, but the person was getting so angry. And what did it do to the person who was getting angry? Just made their fists sore, that's all. What do you want to do that for? You can't change anything. Oh, just let it be. It's not the end of the world. And even if it was the end of the world, wouldn't it be wonderful to have an end of the world? You don't have to. I'd never worry about the end of the world because I know that there's all these superheroes like Batman. They'll come and save us at the end. Isn't that what they're supposed to do? Where are they when we need them? But no, it's not going to be the end of the world. It's just going to be a different thing. And when we learn how to adapt to life by not planning, we learn so much. And it brings me on to the story of one of my old friends a long time ago, Ham Wong. He was a New Zealander who was, when I actually saw him when he came to visit Wat Nanachat, first of all, and I was a young monk there, and then he said he was going to go off to Korea to ordain there. So he was ordained in the Jogje order in Korea, and he went to a very strict monastery. This monastery was so strict that every year they did a retreat, 60 days retreat. And it wasn't for the weak. They had to get up, I think it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and start meditating. 45-minute meditation, 15-minute walking together in the room until they had their breakfast, which was brought to the room for them. So they never went out. And then after eating, walking 45 minutes and 15 minutes, you had to. No jokes. Not like Ajahn. If you ever complain about my jokes, I'll send you to one of them. Because you could go and see the teacher for an interview, but no one wanted to. It was really fierce. And a Zen stick there as well. So this poor New Zealander, sort of even the first day, you know, he was really, really sort of tired and aching. And when it got to the end of the day, 10 o'clock, you could go to sleep. Right where everyone else was meditating, in the Zenda. You didn't go out of there except to go toilet, shower, or meet the master. So it was just, you can't just slip off and have a snooze. Not like, you know, good old Ajahn Brahm's retreats. This, you know, at 10 o'clock, you slept right there. And he said to me, because he told me all about this retreat, he said it's just so tired, just lay down. As soon as you lay down, gong, it was 4 o'clock, start meditating again. It was just, the sleep was like nothing. And so I had another day, and another day, and another day. And he said, I think I wrote about this in one of my first books, after the first 7 days, he's about to give up. And he'd meditated before, but not like this. And he said that every part of his body was aching and on fire, but then he'd look up and he'd see all the Korean monks sitting there very peacefully. And his pride took over. What if they can do it? I can do it. So he kept on pushing through and pushing through and pushing through. And he said that he was just waiting for the halfway mark. Only 30 days to go. Because those 30 days, the last 30 days, were about twice as long as the first 30 days. That's how it felt. And then 2 weeks to go, I can't stand this any longer. He wanted to scream and run. But he'd already done sort of 6 weeks. All that effort and sacrifice would be for nothing. He would be unfaithful to all that pain he'd endured if he gave up now. So he kept on going, minute by minute, second by second, enduring. And then, 1 week to go. Could he make it? Again, the pain, the time. As the pain increased, the time went slower. And soon, the last day. The last day! Only another 24 hours of this retreat to go. And he thought, I can make this. But what happened was that last day, that was the worst. The worst. I think as I wrote, it's like pain was only toying with him for the first time, for the first few days, the first few weeks. Now, it really came out full strength, pulling no punches. Every meditation was just such an endurance test. But of course, this too will pass. Everything eventually must come to an end. But he didn't know which would come to an end first. Him. Or the last 45, only another 45 minutes to go. And then the retreat will be over. And in those Zen retreats, at the end of the retreat, they'd have a big feast. And they'd have hot baths. Much more civilized when we... Do we have a feast afterwards, the retreat, Venerable Posada? Mm-hmm. Hot baths? Yeah. No. But there they had hot baths and a nice feast. And so he was just hanging out the last 45 minutes to have a feast and a hot bath. And as he was waiting 45 minutes, you're not supposed to look up at the clock, but he did. About half an hour had gone past, he thought. He looked at the clock, 5 minutes, that's all. You know what it is when you're waiting for something to happen? The time slows down. The more you want it to finish, the more the clock slows. He was waiting and waiting. Open his eyes, 10 minutes. Can't be. Impossible. It must be at least 40 minutes. And then that's when he told me that he started to fantasize. Maybe the batteries needed recharging in the clock. What would happen if the batteries run out of electricity as it was and it got stuck there? Then what? He'd have to sit forever. And it just dragged on, just so painful, so hard. And then, as it must happen, the bell went. The end of the retreat. And oh, what an achievement that was for him. How amazing feat of endurance, his first 60-day retreat. Sheer pain, agony, torture. But he'd done it. He got through. And he had his legs and back were really stiff, but all this amazing energy and the triumph, the joy was strong. He felt so happy. Bring on the hot baths and let's have a nice feast. And that was the point where the teacher rang the bell again and said, I have an announcement. And he said, during the interviews, Many of you have reported great progress in your meditation. And you've made a request to me, because this is such a wonderful retreat, can we please extend it for another 2 weeks? And I think that's a very good idea, he said. And he rang the bell again, cross your legs and carry on meditating. And this New Zealander, Han Wong, he never felt any pain. He just felt sheer anger. Which totally overcame any physical feelings of pain. He was just so upset, so enraged. And then, of course, the next thing he did was thinking about which were those monks. Because, you know, sometimes you can see them, the smart Alex, and say, oh, it's probably that fellow. And then he started planning all these really cruel and evil acts of torture he was going to do on him once he came out of the retreat. He was really upset and really angry, and just, oh, I'm going to get this. And then the bell went. Half an hour had gone past, like that. And then the teacher said, retreat's over, the bars are out there, and just please have a lovely feast, retreat's over. And then poor old Han Wong, he said, what the heck's going on? Is the retreat over or is it not? You know how Westerners think, you know, just let us know. And he was so confused that one of the monks came up, one of the senior monks, and said, the master, the teacher does this, the same trick every year. And then Han Wong really appreciated that. He said, he learned more in that last half hour than in the 60 days. How expectations and anticipations ruin everything. If he'd just been in the moment, his pain wouldn't have been anywhere near as bad. But wanting to get rid of it, how long I've got to endure this, when is it going to finish, waiting in the future, that causes the pain more than anything else. Number two is just expectations causing anger when you get frustrated because you're out of control. Surely we should know by now that life is out of control. And it's not your fault. In other words, life goes along according to causes and conditions. Bird flu, weather. We try and make the best of it. We try and prepare for the worst. But in the end, things go wrong. If they did not go wrong, then we would learn nothing. And when they do go wrong, we can always look on another side of it. A learning experience. I always learned the best from the teachers I didn't like the most. But I learned so much from them. I learned so much from Ajahn Mosquito, as Ajahn Chah used to say. They're going to teach you a lot. From noise, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. You can't control things, but you can accept them, embrace them, understand them, make use of them, and then they can sort of vanish away. So this is sometimes what we learn. Things which sometimes don't make sense, make things look a little crazy. Just coming back to the time when I was a school teacher. Again, at the end of that year, one of the kids, you know, came top, and the one I really helped. But there's another kid who came bottom. Even in a class of Einsteins, one Einstein would have to come 30th. Doesn't mean you're bad. But isn't it how we judge ourselves against others? Isn't that the big mistake? So this little kid who came 30th in a class of 30, you could see him getting depressed. You never expected such a bad result. Have you ever had that, something really terrible happens to you in your life, and you think, oh my goodness, how can I explain this to my friends? For him, not only would his friends find out pretty soon and call him a dummy, but more than that, his parents would find out that he came bottom of the class, and he was imagining all the terrible things his parents would tell him. No more playing sports, no more going out with your friends. You have to stay behind, get extra tuition, make sure your grades go up. So he got really hunched shoulders, his head went down, he was brooding, depressed. And that's when I went up to him and decided to give him a bit of Buddhist wisdom. They all knew I was a Buddhist by that time, because I'd even, you know, in those old days when you would teach, had assemblies, did you still have assemblies in schools these days? So anyway, every teacher had to take the assembly for a week. So when I took the assembly for a week, instead of reading passages out of the Bible or other stuff, I remember the English teacher, it was the first time he read Jonathan Livingston Seagull over 5 days. You remember that book? Some of you? But anyway, he was in the English and he really knew how to speak, and so it was really exciting. Didn't know what was going to happen in the next episode. So actually all the kids were really alert for that one. So when I went up there, I think a week or two afterwards, I taught them how to meditate. This was in 1973. It could have been 72. 72, 73. And no one had ever taught meditation in school before. Why? And they do it all the time now. So 650 kids from 11 to 17, mixed. And so I told them, I said, okay, I'm going to teach you some meditation now. So all sit with your legs crossed. And had all the kids, from the little 11-year-olds to the 17-year-olds, legs crossed, back straight. And I saw all of the kids just moving. It's like a wave. They all came straight. And then tuck your chin in, right hand over the left hand, thumbs touching. And I taught them how to watch the breath for 5 minutes. And that was amazing that all the kids followed instructions. Not one of the kids giggled or said anything. And afterwards the teachers asked me, said, you were very brave to do that. You were so courageous, because if one child had started giggling, the whole 650 would have giggled. And I've lost any authority which I had. And then I said afterwards, that wasn't courage, that was stupidity. I never thought of that. If I'd have thought of that, maybe I would have done it. But it worked, anyway. And actually got they started clapping afterwards. It was something very different. And they appreciated a bit of peace and quiet, sort of, you know, in that school. But it was a case of, you know, giving it a try and seeing what happens. And not expecting anything. And it worked, but in this class where I was at the end of the year, when I gave out the report cards, this is why I just really don't like judging who's the best, who's the worst, who's in between. That's against the Buddhist principles. But nevertheless, that I had to give out the card, and this one kid had come 30th and bottom, and he sort of was getting depressed and worried about how he's going to sort of say this to his parents. And that's when I went up to him and explained to him some Mahayana Buddhists, Mahayana Buddhism, about the Bodhisattva. Because in Mahayana, a Bodhisattva is someone who sacrifices their happiness to help other beings. And I told this young man that you have sacrificed yourself by deliberately, intentionally, on purpose, taking the bottom position in the class so that your friends will not have to suffer what you're going to get from your parents tonight. You've willingly taken on that suffering to protect all the people you care about and love. Not like your other friends here, just so selfish, thinking about themselves. You think about others. That's why you take the worst position in the class. You are a hero. You're a true bodhisattva. Your sacrifice is a legend. Ooh, okay. Your sacrifice... Somebody has worked out to stop my talk at the right time. Like I said, boom with this thing over here. Anyway, you... How do you work that one out? Anyway, you have taken the bodhisattva position, so I'm going to go straight to the principal's office and recommend you for the Bodhisattva of the Year award in this class. You're a hero. You've done this on purpose. You're so kind and so wonderful and just so loving of others, not thinking of yourself. And I remember him looking at me like I was the craziest teacher he'd ever known. But it got him out of his depression. It made it see it in a different way. But of course, I told him, one of the other things you always have to say is that you're only allowed to be a Bodhisattva of the Year once in your school career. So next year, you do better and let someone else take the bottom position. But anyway, it was just a way of saying that when we measure, who do you think you are? And if you actually become that position, if you think that that's the truth of who you are, of course, that is where you suffer. So, you aren't a great meditator, you aren't a bad meditator. It's not a case, I can't do it. Actually, you can't do it, I mentioned that before. No one can get into jhanas. No, actually, that's true. No one can get into jhanas. But you can't get into jhanas. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. So part of our path, important part of the path, is learning that when we do hold on to pride and a sense of self, expectations, wanting, then we put a big barrier in front of ourselves. When we let go of identity, who we think we are, then anything is possible, especially the deep meditations. So I don't know what you think of your progress in this retreat, but nevertheless, it's not about progress, it's all about ingress. And letting go, because if you think there's more to do, you will think there's more of a sense of self and identity. When there's nothing more to do, nowhere to go, your sense of being starts to disappear. You find out something, that the will and the self, they are the problems, not the solution. And if one can be still, your sense of identity disappears automatically. And you get great understandings on the nature of self. Ego, she go, we all go. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So we have interviews. And during the interviews, if anybody wants to sort of ask for the retreat to be extended. Who knows?